and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really nervous. My friend rode up with me, and we hadn't seen each other for a while, so we were catching up. She was just telling me things that were going on with her, and she was in France and telling me about her trip, and really just kept my mind off being nervous until, like, the last 5 minutes, and then all of a sudden, I was like... And I'm very clumsy person, and I used to think that was from my drinking, but I am in reality just a clumsy person. And so my biggest fear when I have to speak is that I'm going to fall on my way to the podium, or I'll be leaning on the podium too far and do the Kramer thing. So my sobriety date is October 11th, 2005, and I have a home group, and my home group is Young and Sober, and we meet at 8 p.m. on Saturday nights. And I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I have been really blessed by a lot of serendipity, which I think is God in action, because in Richmond we have just an incredible community of women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just picked a meeting out of the where and when and stumbled into some wonderful, wonderful women, and I just can't even begin to tell you, like, what that sisterhood has done for me. It's just really been amazing. So I think my drinking is, like, very typical to most of the drinking that other people talk about. Like many people, my life prior to drinking was really fraught with a lot of screwy perceptions. And I grew up in this house with a mom who had a lot of health problems and was... in and out of hospitals for much of my childhood, and was, you know, unable to work and really do a lot of things that adults can do because of her health problems. And so I had a dad who worked real hard, and I grew up in Fredericksburg, and he worked in D.C., so he had that crazy commute to D.C. and a long day and coming home, and then just had to pick up, like, much of the responsibility on his own. And he is not a very overly emotional person, and a lot of the stress that he experienced was expressed through anger. And so my perceptions of my parents growing up was that they were not reliable. They, I never knew sort of what to expect from either parent, whether or not my mom was going to be well. And the nature of my mom's health problems, she just had a lot of weird perceptions. And there's a lot of uncertainty about, like, what's real in this house, what's real in the world outside, and how do we keep quiet what's real in this house from what's real outside. And I was very fearful and very uncomfortable, and really I'm very smart and imaginative, and I just lived in my head, just really... I mean, I had, like, all these imaginary scenarios where I had, like, I had the star role in the scenario, and that would go throughout my day, like, imagining these pretend places that I lived and people that I knew, and just really lived in this other world, just very daydreamy, but always had a sense of discomfort, and I really attributed that to my parents and the fact that my mother was unstable and not well, and that my father was unstable and prone to angry outbursts. And, you know, long about the time I was maybe in middle school, my family started cropping up in therapeutic settings, and it was really given a license, and I thought, from therapy, based on telling therapists this is what my life has looked like, to not be well. Now, maybe that's not what people were saying to me. Maybe what people were offering me was compassion and understanding, but I really believed that I had been damaged at the hands of these two people who were supposed to love me more than anybody, and any aberrant behavior that I might display was justified based out of a response to that. And I really, I really ran with that ball for a long time. And so my first drinking experience and really the first few years of my drinking, it was apparent, like, from the get-go that I was not a normal drinker. You know, the first time I drank, I was a blackout drinker. And immediately what I liked about alcohol was this very exciting, and all of a sudden the sort of imaginary world that I lived in my head was maybe really possible, you know. I believed that I was beautiful, and I was very clever and very well loved, and I could have the world by the tail when I had that drink in me. And it was very, very powerful and exciting, and just really, from the start, fell in love with drinking. And my first drinking experience was alone, stealing liquor out of my parents', you know, pantry. And my parents always had a profuse amount of alcohol around the house, but they didn't drink so much. And so it was, you know, very readily available. And probably by the time I was going into ninth grade, I understood the trick of putting water in a bottle to make it look like the level was the same. And, you know, that's not normal drinking. That is certainly not normal drinking behavior for a 14-year-old girl. And so at the, you know, beginning part of my life, I grew up in a church, and my parents were extremely religious people. I went to parochial school, and I was really sheltered from a lot of the sort of negative things that occur out there in the world. And I'm really, as a little tiny girl, like, my heroes were Mother Teresa, and I just thought, like, when I grew up, I was maybe going to, you know, be a missionary, and just really wanted to be good and do wonderful things for the world. And then I went into high school after having had that first drink, and I went into a high school that was overcrowded, and, you know, I went from, like, a class of 18 students to a class of, like, 1,200 students, and there was suddenly, like, all of these things that maybe I had been taught were wrong. A lot of them I couldn't even understand. Like, I knew the principle was wrong, but I'd never seen any evidence of anything. And suddenly there was all this stuff, and it was exciting. And then I guess at the same time as well, my mom just got well. And she was really ready to step back into our lives and be a mom. And I wasn't going to have that. I felt completely like, you've abandoned me, and you haven't been available to me. You have no business now coming into my life and telling me what to do, when there are all these exciting and thrilling things right here for me to do, and I'm not having it. And so really, you know, I had that first drink, like, at the end of eighth grade, and by my ninth grade year, I was drinking every weekend. I was drinking several days during the week before going to school. I was shoplifting. I was skipping school. I was, you know, I have a friend who puts it like this, and I'll steal it from him because I think it's really funny. I was smoking outside issues and, you know, smoking cigarettes, and this was really exciting. And not only did all of this stuff seem really thrilling because it was naughty, you know, but I was introduced to this amazing crowd of people who also did all of these things, and man, were they exciting. And I just ran with that. And so this sort of just progressed, and I just was getting wilder and wilder. And my parents' response, you know, having come from this very religious and very right, you know, just doing the right thing kind of family, was to just try to put a lid on the pressure cooker. And I was just wicked. I did wicked, wicked, terrible things to my parents. You know, I set their kitchen on fire one time and, you know, went way out of my way to make it look like it was an accident. And just ultimately, with this just anger, and I'm going to get you, and then let me pretend like this was an accident, and it was this terrible thing that happened, and you should feel sorry for me, and so happy that I'm safe, and nothing bad happened to me, you know. And I ran away from home. I ran away from home over 30 times before I was 17 years old. I one time had a police officer pick me up and tell me that they just kept the Xerox copy of my face in their cars because my parents called so often. And you know, I think I was in 10th grade. I was at a New Year's Eve party, and I got, you know, so drunk, and I was historically like the naked teenage girl at parties, and you know, my friends drive me home and throw my body from the car. I don't remember this at all. I don't know if I was blacked out or passed out, but it's New Year's Eve, it's raining, and I'm naked, and I'm laying in the ditch of my front yard in, you know, water. And my father heard a car and came out and looked and found me. They took me to the hospital on a blood alcohol content of 0.32, you know. That's alcoholic. That's alcoholic. That's not normal drinking. And so, you know, around this time it was suggested that perhaps it was a really good idea to bring me to AA. So I came to my first AA meeting, you know, 10th grade, 2 years after my first drink. And my mom sat beside me and went like that for a little while. And then I was put into like one of these. This is back when they had like long-term treatment facilities. So I was in a treatment facility for 6 weeks. And by the time I was in 11th grade, I was removed from the home and placed in foster care. And still, I'm thinking, thank God someone's hearing finally how terribly abused I am and how awful these people are. And I can't help but behave like this because of the wicked way that they have treated me. And yet I move into this foster home and, you know, all of a sudden their home, which was this for the two, like, most gentle, loving people, and suddenly there's all this chaos happening in their house. And I can't make that connection between, like, me and the chaos, you know, that I can't draw that line, nor can I draw the line that, like, the chaotic things that happen to me in my life are the direct result of the things that I do when I'm drunk. Nor do I have any understanding that I cannot not drink, you know. And this all seems really normal to me. So by my senior year in high school, I end up pregnant. And I have this baby in the fall after I graduate. And another area where I was really able to continue for a really long time of living in this state of delusion is that I am very smart, and I've always been able to be very successful in an academic area. So this is, I just described to you how I'm living it. Somehow or another, I graduate from this high school with honors. And this stacks it up for me, that clearly I'm a victim. Because if something were really wrong with me, I wouldn't be able to be successful in this area. Not understanding also that the way that I operate is that inside I don't feel good. I'm uneasy and uncomfortable. I don't know why. But on the outside, I'm going to show you what I want you to believe about me. I'm going to show you that I have the capacity to be successful and clever and funny, and then maybe I can prevent you from seeing me the way that I see me, because if you saw me the way that I see me, you wouldn't want to have anything to do with me, and then I would be all alone. And that's a terrifying place for me. And you know, at this time also, when I moved out of my parents' house, I just was so glad that I didn't have to go to church anymore. I was tired of having this very dogmatic religion, you know, from my perception, shoved down my throat. And from my perception, it was a very punitive God, and that I was always going to be, I was never going to measure up. And because I am very intelligent, and I like to tell you that because it's my and so I think I'm so intelligent, you know, I clearly can look at the world and it doesn't make sense that there is a God out there, because look at what happens and look at all these organized religions operate. And if there really were a God, these people who represent him would not live the way that they live. And so I just came to a place where I really thought, if you believed in God, then you were quaint, you were simple, you were clearly not clever enough to think for yourself. And I like to refer to people who believed in God as sheeple. You know? So by the time I'm 20, this has just progressed. The outside issues have really progressed for me, and I start to feel very powerful in my mind. Male power is one of the most powerful things out there, and I start to become very interested in gaining male power, whether it's through, I'll be polite and call them relationships, but that's not so much really what they were. Or, you know, I'm have this side business with these outside issues, and I feel like I can drink like a man, and I can play this game like a man, and that was a very powerful place to me. I really felt unstoppable. And I thought, you know, look at me. I'm this single mother with this little baby, and I'm very successful, and I don't need to go to college or get some kind of a job because I can do very well on my own. And look what I can do working 10 hours a week while other people are silly and they're working full time. And so this is the way I'm living, and in reality, here's what's happening. I'm drinking every day. I'm dragging this baby to Grateful Dead shows. I'm living out of a Volkswagen van for a period of time. I eat very little. I'm completely unhealthy, and I have driven in a car with my outside issues underneath the fabric of the car seat, because in my mind, that's the last place a police officer is going to look should he stop me. That's the way that I'm living. But somehow or another, my perception of that is that I'm in the fast lane, and it's exciting and fun. And then the other thing that kind of is happening to me is I'm just cycling through groups of people. Just cycling through groups of people. I'm staying in a group of people until I've had some level of relationship with every man in that group, and I don't understand why their girlfriends don't like me, and, you know, why do they not want to hang out with me? I can't remember. I am almost consistently a daily blackout drinker. And so at the sort of the end of this period of time, I'm living in this apartment above this restaurant because I've now been forced to work in a restaurant because I cannot support my habits without having additional money through my extra money on the side. And I'm not making any money on the side from these outside issues because I'm using my outside issues and I'm owing people money. And I have, you know, angry people coming over to my house. I have this whole host of people who are like homeless people who need a place to stay, who come and stay with me and sleep on my floor. I have no furniture in this place. There's no electricity, and I'm running a power cord out the window to the soda machine in the alley. The window is busted out, and I have stacks of newspapers stuffed in the hall to try to keep the cold out because I can't ask the landlord to replace it because I owe him too much rent money to legitimately ask him to fix something that's broken. I'm eating breadsticks and wedding soup from the restaurant that I'm working at. I'm working from 10 or 11 every morning until the bar closes at night, and somehow I don't even hardly have enough money to smoke cigarettes and drink, and I'm having to steal bottles of wine from the grocery store. And what happens is that the father of this baby serves me with paperwork that he would like custody because he doesn't think that this is an ideal environment for her. And I start looking at this, and I'm feeling guilty. I've got this two-year-old baby sleeping on the floor while all this insanity is happening, and I think to myself, this is not right for her to be in this environment. So I send her to live with my parents. This is alcoholic thinking, okay, because a normal person would look at that and say, this is not the way this baby should be living, therefore I should not live this way. I say, this is not the way this baby should be living, so I'm going to place her somewhere else where she'll be safe because I can't stop living this way. I can't stop, even though I very much want to. So I'm partying one night with this man, and I'm telling him, like, how, you know, this guy wants to get custody of my baby back for me. And I know that I am not a fit parent. I know that. That's why I've sent her to go live at my mother's house. But darn if you're going to tell me that something is wrong with me. I will fight you tooth and nail if you try to make me see something about myself that can't possibly be true. And I will fight you with everything that's in me. So I'm talking to this guy like, what's my position going to be here? You know, because what he's saying, gosh, that doesn't sound so good. And he says to me, you know, I was sober for 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've left. And I have been, you know, he'd been relapsing for 2 months. And he said, I suggest you put yourself in treatment and go to AA. And I was like, that's a smashing idea. The landlord will be off my back. These angry people knocking on the door that I owe money to, they won't know where I am. You know, I can fully honestly say, yes, I did all of these terrible things, but I'm sober now. You know? So that's what I do. I moved home with my parents, and I spent about 6 months, like, just picking up white chips and 30-day chips. And then I just had this shift, and I think it came to me through the fellowship, because I don't think that I ever conceded that I was truly an alcoholic, but I just got some friends in the fellowship, and I wanted, you know, I wanted to be with them. I didn't have any of my other friends anymore, and most of them I actually needed to steer clear of. And so I got sober, and went like this. They said, get a sponsor. So I picked this woman who looked serene to me, and she said, what step are you on? And I said, I'm on 4, because I had read 1 through 3 on the wall, and I had some sense that 4 was supposed to be written. You know, and I missed 1, because there was no concession that this was my identity. You know, and completely missed 2, because this whole time I thought anybody who believes in God is a sheeple. You know, so I wrote out this like inventory and shared with her the things that I thought would be safe to share with her, and kept those other things to myself, and did that 5th step. Didn't do 6 and 7 at all, because how do I ask somebody that I don't believe in to remove my shortcomings from me? And then I made the amends that I thought were necessary so certain people would like me again. And then I met this man in AA, and I fell in love, and it became brilliant to me that I could look back at my life and see that it was trashy and bad. It was not in line with what I had been brought up to believe in. And I thought, what I need to do is go back to college and get an education, get married, have a family, and have a normal life. And so that's what I did. So I stayed sober for 2 years and 10 months, where I stayed drink-free, you know, and drug-free for 2 years and 10 months. And really getting the fellowship part of this, and love to death the fellowship part, and really missing it, the service and the recovery part of this. And, you know, we're married for a while, and, you know, so I sort of have been using the group as my higher power. And that is a very successful approach for many people in AA. And they use Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning. And maybe some people use that forever. Maybe other people, that grows for them to become a god of their understanding. For me, what happened was I started looking at you, and I could see how truly sick you were. You know, that you were liars, and you stole, and you had crummy relationships, and there was no part of you that looked to me to be more powerful or better than me, individually or as a whole. And haven't really conceded that I'm an alcoholic forever and ever, and so somewhere floating around in the back of my mind, I'm missing this part of the power of the group staying sober together. And I just... I moved to a different town. I moved to Charlottesville and started going to meetings there. Didn't like them very much. Wasn't connecting. My sponsor moved to another state. Didn't find another woman who was clearly qualified enough to be my sponsor. started dropping off on meeting attendance because there were people that I didn't care for, and it was 4 meetings a week, and then 3 a week, and then 2 a week, and then 2 a month, and then I wasn't going anymore. And then it started to occur to me that maybe I wasn't an alcoholic. Maybe I was young. I mean, gosh, I was 20 when I showed up, you know? Everybody parties like that when they're 20. You know, everybody runs an extension cord to the soda machine and sets their parents' house on fire and gets a DUI and a blood alcohol content of 0.32, right? This was my youthful escapades, and now I'm going to do the right thing. I'm probably not alcoholic. And my husband and I talk about this for like 10 months. And at the end of this 10 months, well, by the end of 8 months, he came to the conclusion he probably wasn't an alcoholic. And 2 months later, I came to that same conclusion and started drinking again. So now I'm on this mission that I'm going to be a good mother, I'm going to be a good wife, I'm going to live in the suburbs and be smart and educated and belong to all kinds of volunteer organizations. And I am able to have many periods of controlled drinking because I get pregnant. And during these times when I'm pregnant, it's easy for me to stop drinking. It's not easy for me to stop drinking and be comfortable. I'm very unhappy when I'm not drinking. But I chalk that up to hormones and to the being pregnant and the stresses of a new family. It doesn't occur to me that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. So I have 4 more children in 6.5 years because I'm an alcoholic, and so I mean I'm over here, I'm never in the middle, so I think I'm gonna have a family. And you know, so we have these 4 kids. So meanwhile my husband's drinking and his alcoholism is progressing very rapidly. And his alcoholism and mine look different on the outside. I think we both are desperate and unhappy and lonely and miserable. But his behavior is overt, and my behavior is the sneaky, manipulative, twist the knife in you behavior. And I operate from this position that I am a victim. I have already been a victim all my life of my wicked, wicked parents, and now I am a victim of all these other wicked circumstances that befall me. And I'm a victim of him. And clearly something is wrong with him. And I like to tell this story because this is indicative of how sick and controlling and manipulative my alcoholism can be. And it's the kind, it flies under the radar. And so I think that it's not that I know what is right and you don't. It's just that I know what is true. And you're probably not, you don't have enough clarity yet to see it my way. So I'm going to explain to you in several different ways until I'm able to, you know, break through to you so that you can come to see things as I do, which is the truth. And so here's an example of this. I believe that when you brush and floss your teeth, that the proper order for that is first we brush and then we floss. And this man was like a flosser, then a brusher. And this is disturbing to me because in my home we do things my way. You know, I don't understand that this is the actor directing the show and that I am so unhappy with myself that how this person brushes his teeth disturbs me. That's bad. That is a complete lack of serenity if I can't allow you to have your personal hygiene in peace. And so we have this argument over and over and over, and I finally go to the dentist one time. And I'm like, this is how else I work. I got to bring on, I either have the big boys behind me. You know, I like to back up my position with some other authorities beside myself. In case you are silly enough to think that I am not telling you the truth, I got this team back here that's on my side. So I said, look, can you explain to me what's the correct order of brushing and flossing? Because I know that we're supposed to floss after we brush, and my husband does it backwards. And I've been trying to explain it to him, and can you tell me so I can go home and let him know? And they just The hygienist and the dentist, their mouths are hanging open. What is wrong with this woman? And the hygienist is like, we're just so happy when people come on. And this is how I am. I'm like, time's up, not down in the dishwasher. You know, we're going to do it my way. If you're not going to do it my way, I'm going to follow you from room to room to room to room to room, and I am not going to give you any peace until you will agree to do things the way that I think you should. Because I can't be comfortable unless you are living your life the way I need you to live it so that I can be okay. And so things progress and progress, and all of a sudden, you know, this is what I'm doing. I'm coming into PTA meetings, getting up at the podium in the PTA meeting and telling them how the PTA should be run, and I'm drunk. And I have a gin and tonic in my coffee mug, and I'm getting up there telling them, I can't believe we have a McDonald's night as a fundraiser when 30% of the students in our county are obese. That's not healthy. I, however, am here as, you know, the homework telling this. You know. And then I would leave the PTA meetings and wonder, like, you know, why don't those wenches like me? Why does nobody like me? And this is progressing, and so this is what I think is happening. I have taken my kids out of school, and I'm homeschooling them. I'm eating organic food and drinking organic milk. And I want to be perfect. I want to be perfect at all of this so that it will look good and I will feel better if I can just manage to do all of these things perfectly. So I want to be a runner, and so I'm going to run 25 miles a week, and I'm taking 1,000 milligrams of Advil in the morning so that I can go running. And I just think, who doesn't take 5 Advil in the morning when they wake up? You know, it's like a supplement. And I'm running 25 miles a week and stopping on the side of the road to vomit while I'm running because I'm so sick and hungover. And I'm thinking, I also have to be thin, you know, because I have to be attractive. And so I'm going to allow myself to eat 1,200 calories a day. And then when I wake up in the morning, I'm going to try to remember how many drinks I had and subtract those calories from the 1,200. And that leaves me with an apple or a yogurt. And then as all of this is happening and I'm homeschooling these children, they have 10 instructional days in a year's time. What they're doing is they're running up and down the street barefoot all the livelong day playing. And inside I feel like I am a piece of trash. I feel like garbage. I feel so confused because I'm doing all of these things that should be in line with this white picket fence life that I'm trying to have. And I'm fighting with my husband every night. You know, the police come to our house for our domestic disturbances. Things are broken in my house. Everything is spinning out of control and falling apart, and no matter how much I redouble and triple my efforts to make things right, it still is going crazy, and I'm confused, I'm baffled, and I'm lonely. I'm so lonely, despite the fact that I'm living with 6 other human beings. I am so lonely inside that I believe that it is possible to die from that feeling. I just drive down the road and I look at bridges and I look at trees and I just want to die. I still don't understand that this is alcoholism. Now, during the course of this, at one point, my husband had tried to choke me, and he put himself into a treatment or a hospital because he didn't know where it was coming from. He didn't even remember doing it. And after his couple of days, they call me to come in and have like this exit interview with the professionals. And I come in there, and I'm wearing a turtleneck because my neck is bruised. And I sit down, and they say, "Jen, you're an abused wife, and we are diagnosing your husband with alcoholism. What can we do to help you? And I said, you know, that is not true. I am not an abused wife, and he is not an alcoholic. Because if I conceded that he was an alcoholic, what would that mean about me? So not only are things this crazy, and I know something's clearly wrong with him, but I can't label it. I can't call attention to it. At all costs, I have to hide it and let it be okay because it's like a direct reflection on me. And so how this comes to a head is there's this, you know, other situation where, sort of three things happened in a row. I'm going back to graduate school because that's the secret to my happiness, to continue my education. And I'm sitting in this meeting with the advisor of the department, and she shares with me about some alcoholic family members. And I just had this moment of clarity, and I remember, like, the sun was, like, coming through in the afternoon. There's, like, a shaft, and I can see, like, the dust and the light. And I was just staring at that, and all of a sudden it hit me, like, I met this man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wonder if I am an alcoholic. And just tuck that in the back of my mind. It's very uncomfortable. Not ready to look at it, but now it's been thought, so now it's floating in there. And then I'm sitting in the parking lot at this grocery store, and I'm just weeping. I'm just weeping. I don't understand. I've tried so hard to make this good life for myself and my family, and it's just garbage. And I feel as if I am dead inside. And, you know, I'm only 32. I have, like, the second half of my life coming, and this, what if this is it? And I'm just weeping, and I don't know why I said this, but I must have exhausted all other thoughts or ideas, but I just said, God, if there's a God out there, please take this pain away from me. And the pain did not go away by any means, but I instantly had this feeling that I was not alone. And it was so startling to me that I called a friend of mine who's a very spiritual person and has always lived her life that way, and I described it to her to ask her, like, what do you think this was? Do you think this was a spiritual experience? It was profound and moving to me, and I'm still not even sober. But from that moment on, that has been something that I can pull back to. No matter how nutty I'm getting in my head, I can return to that. And that has been a truth for me since then. And so then the last thing that happened is that we had this other, like, domestic disturbance. And the police came, and my husband was arrested, and he was charged with a felony. And my kids woke up to see their dad being put in the back of a cop car. And I was standing in this, like, torn-up shirt and my underwear with my 8-year-old son standing beside me, having to give this horrific and shameful account to the police of what had happened. And in that moment, and again, I don't know why, but in that moment, I just knew that I was an alcoholic. I believed it. Like, I describe it like this. Like, I believed it to the bone. Like, as much as I know that I'm woman, as much as I know what color my skin is, I knew that it was true. And I never wanted to live that way again. I had no idea how things would be different. I had no belief that things would be better. But I just knew that I was finished with that part of my life. And so I come back to you. And This time, the first 4 months of me being sober was the lowest time of my life. This was even lower than these last few drinking escapades. I was going to one meeting a week. I was incapable of showing up at school and getting homework done. I was incapable of cleaning my home. I could not make meals for my children. I had a collection of women friends from school who for like 3 weeks brought dinners into my house. I couldn't I would sit in my chair and get on the World Wide Web and look for the end of the internet, you know, and there was cereal in the cabinet. You know, these kids are running up and down the road, barefoot, unsupervised. I just couldn't do anything. And all I wanted to do was die. There was not any time from when my eyes opened to my eyes shut, and there was very little sleep in between, where I thought I wanted to do anything other than to die. There was, and although I had this sense that there was a God and I was not alone, I had no hope. And I only continued to go to meetings for two reasons. One, I didn't know what else to do. And two, the first meeting that I chose to go to, I thought there were attractive men there. And that was it. And, like, thank God for lust. You know how we believe that, like, our character defects are removed when they are no longer of service to us or others. My lust has served you well. So, you know, I come for 4 months, and I'm just not getting any better, and I'm getting worse. And I don't understand this, because I've now put together that I shouldn't drink, but I feel worse. I can't stand anybody, and I have panic attacks all the time. I go to stores, and this is why I start thinking, oh, my God, the people in the store can look at me, and they can see what a piece of garbage I am inside any minute now. They're going to look at me, and they're going to see what a lie my life is. And I come in here like this well-dressed, educated white woman with this nice family, and in reality, I am a piece of garbage, and I am so lonely and desperate, I spend all my free time thinking about the various methods that I'm going to take my own life. And at the end of this 4 months, I come to this group, which is my home group, and I said to them, I don't understand. I'm doing what you're telling me to do, and I'm not well. You know, and after the meeting, some really amazing, kind people pulled me aside and explained to me that I wasn't so much doing what you were telling me to do. What you were telling me to do was to go to many meetings a week and to find a sponsor and to start taking these steps. And that there was where the solution to my discomfort was. So I think I'm going to be very brave, and I step it up from one meeting a week to two, and I pick the one that's closest to me, and I walk in, and sitting across the room from me is my neighbor who's lived across the street from me for several years, whom I've liked in the past, thought about inviting her over to drink beers with me. She had a lot of friends who were police officers, and I was very nervous about inviting someone who's a friend of a police officer into my life. And we used to refer to her as Cop Girl. And in that moment, when I saw her, I just thought, like, this is a sign. I don't know so much about God, but clearly this is happening for a reason. So I just said, will you sponsor me? It's no fun. And she said, sure. So we started getting together, and this is how it went. She opened this book up, and she read to me like I was five, line by line, what the words said. And she would tell me, she'd read me one sentence, and then she'd tell me like 15 minutes of her story. And then she would say, ask me, can I relate to that? And I'm like, what's happening here? I'm here to get well. Let's step it up and get this reading done, you know. And she said, well, do you know what this word means? And I'd think, do you know who I am? You have no idea how intelligent I am, you know. I know that I'm smarter than you. Of course I know what that word means. And I didn't understand that process of identifying, like, it's in the talking, I think, in those first few chapters. I can identify with a lot of Bill's story. I get a lot of relief from the doctor's opinion in understanding the physical allergy component of my alcoholism and the craziness that makes me believe that it's a good idea to drink in spite of startling evidence to the contrary. But where I identified most was one-on-one with her telling me about her life and the startling places where my life looked just smack the same of it. And so then I was getting excited, and I wanted to be more well, because I really started to believe, like, things might be different for me. And I could look at her and see that she truly did live this way in her outside life. And I wanted that. And so I said, we need to step it up here. Can we move a little faster? And she said, okay, but the only time I have available to you is 6 o'clock in the morning before I go to work. I'm not going to come over and knock on your door. You're going to have to come and get me. And so I knew what she was saying. I'm very adolescent, and I'm thinking, oh, she doesn't think I'm going to do it. You know, I will show her. And so that's what we did. And I met with her every morning, and we went through this book. And she told me much later that she had written this little note. Eventually, she did come over to my house because I had all these children there. And she had written on this little note, like, Jen, I knocked on your door, and you didn't answer. Call me when you're willing or whatever. But I always opened the door to her, and she never had the opportunity to put the note on my door, and that she didn't really so much want to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and read with me every morning. There were many mornings where she would have preferred to, you know, be in her bed, but this woman has illustrated to me what it is like to lead a life of service, that even when I don't want to show up, I show up, and that example of her showing up at 6 o'clock in the morning has stuck with me and has been so helpful to me at times when I feel like I don't want to answer the phone, I don't want to go to this dumb committee meeting, I don't want to, you know, show up with this and read with this person who I know doesn't really want to get well, you know, and all those sort of selfish things that I think I can't shake that thought that someone got up for me at 6 o'clock in the morning 5 days a week for several months. And so what has happened to me, is a little bit kind of, it's disappointing to me sometimes that I didn't just arrive. Like I thought I was going to, like, I'm going to work these steps, I'm going to arrive, and I'm going to be well, I'm never going to think selfish things, I'm never going to be jealous, I'm never going to be irritable again. That has not been my experience at all. And, living as a single parent with these 5 kids in the home, I have a lot of opportunity to see how very impatient I am, how intolerant and irritable I can be, and my incredible jealousy for how other people's lives seem to look so much more smooth and comfortable than mine does. And but what the steps have given me is that when I arrive at this place where that's how I'm thinking, and I start getting very uncomfortable, even when I'm not taking wrong action, even when I am still showing up and doing the right thing, I don't like walking around feeling like I'm so jealous of you that I really want to spit on your face. That doesn't feel good to me. And so I just keep going through this process where I start to recognize unmanageability. I believe that in some way God is going to relieve that for me if I can align my life with what I think His will for me is, and that in order for me to do that, I have to write some inventory. I have to share that with somebody else. And in the process of that, I really uncover more places where my faith is weak. And that's really what it comes down to for me now, that whenever I am angry with you or jealous of you or afraid of you, generally, I can sort of distill that down to some type of fear of abandonment and some dissatisfaction with what that might look like due to a lack of faith. And my most recent experience with that was I had been sick for a little while, and I had been going to the doctor, and I had gotten, like, just really crummy news about my health. And on the day that happened, a woman that I go to school with and met when we were both not sober, and she's now also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is just another beautiful example of God putting us side by side in 2 chairs in a classroom. But she had called me to tell me about this wonderful job she had gotten. And it's very exciting for her, and it's what she loves to do, and, you know, everything attached to it is great. And she's telling me how she's going to fix her office up, and I'm on the other line, and I'm so selfish and jealous. There's no part of me that can have any joy for my friend that she had this wonderful opportunity, because I'm thinking, I am a single mother of 5, struggling through graduate school, scarcely employed, living in a broken down house, and I'm an alcoholic, and now I have this health problem. How come she gets all of this? You know, that's wrong. And so I sort of running with this for about a week, and I come to this conclusion that clearly, in some way, I've done something wrong, and God is punishing me. You know, clearly, I can't figure out what it is, and I start trying to think of every mistake that I've made in the last several months, and is it this, and is it that? And I get to this place where I'm so uncomfortable because I think there are some things in my life that are wonderful for me right now. I'm getting this graduate education. I've got a great job for this summer. I have a host of friends that I care about. I'm in a relationship with someone who is very kind and loving. These are good things, but I'm thinking those things are, I'm going to lose those things because I've done something wrong. I don't know what it is. And God is going to take all of those wonderful things away from me. Because deep down, he probably doesn't think that I am good and worthy of having good things. And still there's something the matter with me. In some way, I am damaged and I am less than you. And from the process of writing out this inventory, I come to see that this is my rudimentary conception of God right now, that I really believe that I'm not worthy and that I have this impending sense of doom that I'm going to be punished continually for all of my life. And yet this other piece of that in spite of that, there's this bulk of serious evidence in my life that things do come to me from God. They absolutely do not look like what I think they should look like. There was no part of me when I was like 8 or 10 years old and I thought, oh, when I grow up, I hope I get to be, you know, an alcoholic, unemployed, single mother of 5 living in a broken down house. That's not the life that I imagined for myself. And yet when I come to these places where I feel uncomfortable, I have this solution for how to come back to feeling at peace, seeing where my faith is weak, and asking God to help me to walk through that, to ask God to help me to be willing to believe that you are not punishing. Help me to be willing to believe that you believe that I am whole and good as everybody else, because that is really our principle of anonymity, is that we are all the same. That is what we say when we say the Lord's Prayer and we say, Our Father, we're calling on our birthright from God that we are good because He is our Father. We are saying, Our Father, because we are calling upon God that we are all entitled to that same birthright. You know, and I forget that. And I forget that in a moment of my, like, alcoholic selfishness, that this is not adding up the way I think it should add up. And that it's managing my life when I start thinking, I can't be okay that I'm a human being and I make mistakes. Where's the mistake so I can figure out the action to take so that I can be perfect, so then I can get the things I need? You know, and it's so subtle. It's the way that I operate. I don't even recognize a lot of times that it's feeling, except that it's happening, except I feel like sick in my gut. And so I just have really come to understand that what this program has offered me is a very slow and long path of walking towards a better understanding of my God. And the ability to, and we say conscious contact, you know, that ability to be connected more often, more readily, you know, with fewer of my old ideas attached to that. And for me, it is a slow process, but I find it to be very beautiful. And what I know about, like, what our book says is that, like, all we had to have was a willingness, just to be willing to think that there might be a God out there. I don't even have to think there is one. I don't even have to think of what it is. I just have to be willing that maybe it is. And so that's the willingness that I try to return to when I go through one of these inventories, when I am doing my sixth and my seventh step. That let me just have the willingness to believe that God is a little bit bigger today than He was for me yesterday. And that's all I have. Thank you.